Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Late last year, Bank of America decided to buy Merrill Lynch. Then CEO Ken Lewis got cold feet. After a conversation or two with the Fed chairman and the Secretary of the Treasury and, oh, by the way, another $20 billion bailout, all of a sudden, the deal was back on. Today, Congress wanted to know why. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, in support of poetry on American Public Media programs. More information online at poetryfoundation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 11th of June. And when you think about all the things that went wrong to get the U.S. economy to where it is today, Bank of America's takeover of Merrill Lynch last fall might not be at the top of the list. But really, it is one of the more curious episodes. Today, B of A CEO Ken Lewis told the House Oversight Committee that, yeah, he did feel he was being squeezed by Bernanke and Paulson to close that Merrill deal, but that was okay.
It was in the context of them thinking that was in the best interest of Bank of America and the financial system.
Both the Fed chairman and the former Treasury Secretary will have the chance to give Congress their version of events sometime soon. But in the meanwhile, we asked Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson what else Congress should be trying to learn about how we wound up in this mess.
Start asking the experts, and you'll get a lot of different views about what topic number one should be for congressional investigators. Here's banking consultant Bert Ely.
The tax laws, which provide an incentive for both individuals and businesses to over-leverage themselves.
That is, borrow too much. Ely says Congress should also look at rating agencies that gave good ratings to a lot of bad debt. Former Fed economist Morris Davis thinks they should focus on the distorted incentives that led institutions to take too much risk. But he says Congress should be careful.
Just because we observed a negative payout doesn't necessarily mean that there was lots of inappropriate behavior. It means that people were taking risks, and that's what we want them to do.
Martin Bailey, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, headed President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He says all this disagreement proves the need for investigation.
I think it's very important that we probe deeper, and I say that because I still hear very different views being expressed by quite well-informed people about what was the main trigger event.
Bailey says Congress should take a step back.
I would rather see us go a little more slowly on reform, on how to fix the system, until we've really made sure we understood exactly what went wrong.
The best way to do that, he says, is a 9/11-style commission, which was just formed by Congress. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The President of the United States is a big basketball fan, as you may know, and as such, I'm sure he understands the importance of good defense. Keep pressuring your opponents to force them to play your game. At a town hall meeting in Wisconsin today, the President applied the legislative equivalent of a full-court press on health care, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
At $2.5 trillion a year, President Obama said the U.S. has the most expensive health care system in the world. And for the health of the economy, he said, something must be done.
Today, we've already built an unprecedented coalition of people who are ready to reform our healthcare system. Yes. Physicians and health insurers, businesses and workers, Democrats and Republicans.
But there are growing cracks in that coalition as Congress works out the details, such as the proposal for a government-run insurance option for the uninsured. House Republicans today rejected that notion. Missouri's Roy Blunt.
This idea of a government takeover of health care just simply will not fly with the American people.
But there are 50 million uninsured Americans, and reformers say that's why the system needs fixing. The Kaiser Family Foundation's Diane Rowland is a veteran of health reform efforts.
Years ago, we were really looking at a single proposal put out there and then taken apart. Instead, what we have here is trying to work through to get more consensus before there's a single proposal.
The president's full court press continues Monday with a speech to the American Medical Association. The AMA has put the administration on notice that doctors don't support a government plan that forces them to participate. But the AMA says it is committed to passing reform this year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Oil rose today, so did stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yesterday, the White House outsourced its supervision of executive compensation. The president named longtime Washington mediator Kenneth Feinberg to manage pay packages at some of the biggest companies that took bailout money from the TARP. That'd be the likes of Citigroup, Bank of America, and General Motors, too. We called him up to talk about it, how that might work. Ms. Feinberg, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
How much power do you have in your new job?
Well, the law grants to the secretary, who delegates to me, the authority to determine compensation packages for 175 senior executives of the seven largest corporate top recipients. The law also permits me, or requires me, to design compensation programs for these recipients, governing overall compensation of every senior official. And finally, the law gives me great discretion in deciding whether I should seek to recoup funds that have already been distributed to executives by top recipients. So it's a substantial delegation of power to one person.
How are you going to make up your mind? Are you going to sit down and review market-based compensation schemes and all that sort of stuff that regular human resources compensation professionals do?
Oh, I think that that'll be part of it. I think the regulations lay out some variables that I must consider in deciding compensation: profitability of the company, merit pay, whether or not loss of officials will inhibit or undercut competitiveness of that company. There's a wide range of factors that I will consider in consultation with the companies themselves.
Do you buy, speaking of those companies, do you buy their argument that compensation limits on their executives will make them, just by market forces alone, lose talent to people who can pay?
I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think that. Now, that's not the only variable, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are other variables that have to be considered. But I think I would have blinders on not to recognize that in some companies, in some respects, the failure to compensate adequately will put a company at a distinct disadvantage prospectively. That is certainly one factor that should be considered in the overall effort to regulate pay.
Well, given that then, and given the fact that executive compensation is a very hot political issue on Capitol Hill now and on Wall Street as well, is it possible, do you think, that the Treasury Secretary gave you a job that he was not eager to do himself?
Oh, you'll have to ask the Secretary that. I don't think it's a question of he's not eager to do it himself. I think it's a question of immersing oneself in this one major area of public policy when the secretary's engulfed in 100 different major areas of public policy. And I must say that although you are absolutely correct that there is a real populist strain in this country where the citizenry is rightfully upset at the compensation levels of some of these executives, there is also a prevailing view that you hear all the time. I'm sure you've heard it. It's none of the government's business to insinuate itself into private marketplace compensation decisions. So there's the real tension that I confront.
Kenneth Feinberg is the new special master for compensation for the Treasury Department. He's working pro bono, I should add. Is that right, Mr. Feinberg?
That's correct.
Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
Before the administration's big announcement yesterday about its latest idea for executive compensation, its third try at it, by the way, Congress had already spoken. Laws are already on the books that limit golden parachutes for banks that accepted federal aid. But that hasn't stopped a lot of banks from paying huge sums to executives who are on their way out the door. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports now in a collaboration with the investigative newsroom ProPublica.
Mack Whittle built the bank, the Southern Financial Group, from the ground up. He founded it in the 80s and then bet heavily on the Florida real estate market during the boom. When the bust hit, large shareholders like Jack McMullen saw their stock investments collapse.
It went from $25 a share down to a low of, I think, about 65 cents.
McMullen says he lost more than $1 million, and by late October, it was obvious to him Southern Financial needed government aid to survive. The very same day the bank applied for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, it also moved up the retirement date for Whittle, its CEO.
They sent him out the door with $17 million.
Investors like McMullen were furious. If Whittle had stayed on after the bank accepted federal aid, his golden parachute would have been considerably smaller. But despite TARP's ban on lavish severance packages, big payments for departing executives have continued. Paul Hodgson's at the Corporate Library, a consulting firm that tracks executive compensation.
Almost as soon as these regulations came out, there were concerns that companies would immediately employ consultants to try and find ways around it.
In February, Congress tightened the screws, banning all severance payments for top executives. And yesterday, the administration issued new rules. But many banks already found ways around the ban. Associated Bank Corp, based in the upper Midwest, took $500 million in federal aid last fall. Then this May, it paid its chief operating officer, Lisa Binder, $1.6 million to leave. But don't call it a golden parachute. Instead, Binder signed an agreement not to compete against the bank. The Corporate Library's Hodgson calls that cheating.
This is obviously a move on their part to somehow get around semantically the clause in the TARP regulations that prohibits payment for doing nothing.
In Virginia, Hampton Roads Bank shares took more than $80 million in federal aid, then paid its departing CEO Jack Gibson $1.3 million. The bank's also paying for Gibson's car and his golf club membership. But this deal wasn't a severance either. According to the bank, it's a three-year consulting contract with a twist. Gibson was paid entirely up front. And the bank says the Treasury Department signed off on the deal.
The consulting agreement is a tried and true way of not calling something a severance.
James Rita is a New York-based compensation expert. He says sometimes it's worth it to keep a former CEO on the payroll, but...
My experience has been after about 6 or 7 months, he or she runs out of things to do. It kind of becomes a sham at that point.
As we've just heard, Washington lawyer Kenneth Feinberg will oversee compensation for the biggest recipients of government money, companies like AIG, GM, and Citibank. But more than 500 banks receiving close to $80 billion in TARP money won't fall under his supervision. In the past 6 months, more than half a dozen of those banks have paid executives to leave. One bank bought its former CEO's house. Others have offered to defer guaranteed payments. And it's unclear if Treasury can or will do anything to get this money back. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, style and the stock market blues.
Fashion always responds, and that was a very dramatic response, because when you think of 87, that was the year that Christian Lacroix introduced the poof skirt, and things were getting really over the top.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up 0.3% today, 31 points, closed at 8,770. The NASDAQ climbed 0.5%, 9 points, ended at 1,862. The S&P 500 turned up 0.6%, 5 points, finished the session at 944. While Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis was on Capitol Hill, B of A's stock was on the rise, up more than 8% today after analysts raised their ratings on the bank. Other financials, though, didn't have quite as good a day. J.P. Morgan Chase took home 0.25%. Morgan Stanley banked 0.75%. Boeing lost altitude. That after cutting forecasts for new plane orders, its shares gave back more than 3% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.69%. Keep your eye on that number, everybody. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Superbrands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Superbrands for more information. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. A House committee holds a hearing on the closure of GM and Chrysler dealerships. Chrysler aims to close up 789 dealerships this week, and GM wants to eliminate about 2,500 by the end of next year. The International Labor Organization marks World Day Against Child Labor with a report highlighting the exploitation of girls. And TV goes digital. Analog signals will be 86 tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Obama administration announced today it's expanding a sales tax deduction for people who buy new cars. Earlier this week, the House approved a plan to give drivers up to $4,500 for trading in their old clunkers for more fuel-efficient models. That's all on top of the billions General Motors and Chrysler are already receiving directly. So we asked our senior business correspondent Bob Moon to total up the subsidy sticker price.
Maybe you've turned on the radio lately and heard the news.
Buyers of new cars can deduct the sales tax even if they don't itemize. This break applies to vehicles purchased before next January. Sales tax on the first $49,500 is deductible.
Add to that the so-called Cash for Clunkers program making its way through Congress, and what's the price tag for taxpayers? Sean McElinden is chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We asked him for a rough guess.
The sales tax deduction in a 10-11 million market could be worth $4 billion, and the cash for clunkers, if used for anywhere from 900,000 to 1.2 million vehicles, could be in the area of about $3 to $4 billion extra, so maybe anywhere from $7 to $8 billion.
McElinden is quick to point out the purpose of all that money isn't just to subsidize Detroit and new car buyers. He says the benefits could ultimately outweigh the cost.
The job impact could be up to 120,000 additional U.S. jobs within 12 months. Obviously, that would bring back some of the tax revenue. So it's possible the net effect could be pretty close to zero.
That'll depend, of course, on how successful these programs actually are. But at the National Automobile Dealers Association, spokesman Bailey Wood says a version of the Cash for Clunkers idea is already proving itself overseas.
The program over in Germany is going literally gangbusters. The dealers are having a great difficulty keeping up with demand because of it.
Wood argues with new car purchases accounting for 20% of all retail sales in this country, these kinds of incentives are just what the economy needs. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The federal budget deficit is $79 million smaller today, thanks in no small part to Wall Street's last big scandal from 6 years ago. A federal judge has ruled that the balance left in a fund from a settlement over fraudulent stock research has to be turned over to the Treasury Department. Stock researchers, or analysts, are the ones who make those buy, sell, and hold recommendations on various companies that you hear about. And it turns out that the investment banks those analysts work for were often trying to win business from some of those same companies. And the analysts were hyping stocks to customers that they were secretly panning in conversations with their colleagues. As part of the settlement, the banks wound up paying more than $450 million toward a fund for independent stock research. That fund is set to expire next month, and Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that could wind up costing investors.
When regulators first announced their settlement with the big Wall Street firms, New York Stock Exchange Chairman Dick Grasso made a proclamation.
It is time to close this, perhaps one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern finance.
It sounds almost quaint, given this latest dark chapter. But at the time, it was a big deal. The brokerage houses agreed to split their investment banking and research divisions to limit conflicts of interest. And they promised to provide their clients with a second opinion on stocks from independent research firms, that is, firms that don't do investment banking. Michael Mayhew tracks the research industry at Integrity Research Associates. He says the money from the settlement helped several independent firms get off the ground. But as of next month, they'll have to stand on their own.
There were 60 to 70 independent research firms that received monies as part of the settlement, right? And that will go away. And the big question is whether or not those independent research firms have discovered a business model that will enable them to stay in business.
Thank you for calling Morningstar. May I help you?
One of the biggest winners in the settlement was Morningstar in Chicago. You may know it for its mutual fund ratings. Morningstar's analysts also researched 2,000 companies. That research helps institutions and individuals figure out how to invest their money. Catherine Udelbu heads the Equity Research Group. She says settlement money made up 4% of Morningstar's revenue last year. That's $21 million Morningstar may have to do without.
It's certainly a hole, but not one that we weren't aware of. And as you can see, 4% of Morningstar's total revenue, it's not a huge number from a total company perspective.
Udelbu says her firm has been preparing for this day. It's developed other lines of business. This week, the company announced a deal with NASDAQ to provide research on companies listed on the exchange. Indie firm Argus Research and two others struck a similar deal with the London Stock Exchange. Analyst Michael Mayhew says independent firms will live on beyond the settlement by charging institutional investors like hedge funds and mutual funds for their research.
The problem I see is what happens to retail investors.
People who still own individual stocks. Mayhew says most of them still get their information from the big Wall Street firms. He says that research appears less biased than it used to be. The firms are much more likely to recommend selling a stock than they were before the settlement. But Mayhew says the downturn has led the big brokerage houses to cut back their research departments. Some of the firms in the original settlement don't exist anymore.
Right now, they're under a lot of pressure. And we're seeing a lot of coverage decline as a result. And you know, who does that hurt? Well, that hurts the guys who can't afford any other kind of research, retail investors.
Some Wall Street firms may offer their clients an independent second opinion even after the settlement expires. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney says it will. If your broker doesn't, there are places you can go, like investing newsletters and websites, for a price. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On the theory that too much talk of stock research and Wall Street regulation is really never a good thing, let us detour here for a minute into the world of fashion. Yeah, it's a bit of a turn, but recession-related, I promise you. We've got Kate Betts back on the line to help me out with the economics of style. Kate, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we have you actually because of purses. Apparently, there was a discussion, not one that I was involved in, but there was a discussion around here about purses the other day and how they are plainer these days, less fringe, less flash. Is that something that's happening to design right now, just less?
And it's not just purses either, by the way. It's clothing, too. I think people are reverting back to what's classical and what is more enduring in terms of style because they feel nervous about the economy, obviously. And also, I think people are tired of these trends and the idea that fashion changes so quickly and it's so instantaneous now. So I think they're looking for something that is lasting and not trendy and doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles.
And also something that you don't have to necessarily replace next year when it goes out of style, right? So they're buying these
exactly.
things that are going to last a couple of years.
Exactly. And I think when you look at some of the luxury companies or the only luxury companies that are still doing relatively well, it's companies like Hermès that are very traditional and very classical.
Is it possible also that these fashion houses are looking to cut their own expenses so they're designing things that are less expensive for them to produce?
Yeah, that's possible on some level. I think people are looking for ways to cut costs, and that is certainly a way to do it. I think also it cuts the cost for the consumer, and I think a lot of people are producing lesser price points in the market so that they can attract the consumer.
Think back in history with me for a little while here. Is there another parallel, thinking of 87 and the stock market crash then? I mean, did fashion respond in a similar way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, fashion always responds. And that was a very dramatic response, because when you think of 87, that was the year that Christian Lacroix introduced the poof skirt and things were getting really over the top.
All right, wait. Because when I think of 1987, that's not what I think of. Christian who and the what?
Christian Lacroix, the French couturier, okay, who actually just filed for Chapter 11, introduced the poof skirt, and all this very exaggerated, elaborate design was coming out of Paris. And that was kind of the look, you know, huge shoulders, bright jewel tone colors, lots of embroidery, kind of, you know, very garish almost.
Yeah.
And then the stock market crashed and you saw the paring down once again. And all of a sudden we had minimalism, and we had designers like Jill Sander and Calvin Klein and Helmut Lang, and everything was very pure and black and white and gray. And, you know, people were wearing very simple kind of pantsuits. And that was a very, very exaggerated difference from what came in 1987.
Well, and arguably, I mean, this whole event that we're having now economically is bigger than what happened in 87. Are we going to go back to blacks and grays and plain and very straight lines and all that?
It's not going to be black and white and gray, because actually the consumer has really adopted color and become very comfortable wearing color. So I would say we're going to see things that are classical, but maybe special in the way that they are in their colorway or in their pattern or the way that it's fabricated. But I think we are going to see an increasing paring back of the silhouette and more tailoring and probably fewer looks. You know, I think designers will make their collections smaller and make the offerings smaller so that they don't have to produce as many clothes.
Kate Betts, she's the editor-in-chief of Time, Style, and Design. Kate, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a blow for shareholder rights, kind of. A couple of years ago, North Dakota passed a law to make it easier for shareholders in companies incorporated there to challenge management. Perhaps not too surprisingly, or not surprisingly at all, the state hasn't had a single company relocate until today. Shareholders in American Railcar Industries voted this afternoon to change the company's registration from management-friendly Delaware to North Dakota. Here comes the kicker, though. American Railcar's biggest shareholder, a guy whose name is usually preceded by the words activist investor, that'd be Carl Icahn. And this would be Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 31 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq climbed 9 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 bounced up 5 points, 0.6% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, all those unwanted goods from China that we're not buying. Where or where to put them?
We're seeing a lot of factories that are sending us emails, photos, lists of containers of goods that says, we've got 5 containers of furniture that was supposed to go to a box store. They canceled the order. Would you like any of it?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.